welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 277 of the podcast. And it is the 9th of July, 2016, as I record this. Today, I have an interview with Kate Palm Kornsmeyer, who is a freelance food writer. And I found this interview fascinating because so many freelance writers do a lot for free. And Kate has a lot of confidence around her value and pitching the right places for the right income. So if you're interested in food writing or freelance writing or the money mindset, I think you'll find this interesting. And just so we're clear, freelance writing is still selling your time. So if you're going to use it for spike income or day job style income, which is, you know, completely brilliant, then be sure to build assets at the same time that will last longer because, you know, you don't own your freelance writing. Okay, so in publishing news this week, Orna Ross, the founder of the Alliance of Independent Authors and a good friend of mine, wrote an insightful piece this week on whether indie authors really are independent. And I'll link to that in the show notes. That's on selfpublishingadvice.org, which is a great blog. And, you know, it really questions, you know, how much have we broken out of the old way of doing things? How much are authors dependent on new gatekeepers or one company for payment? You know, are we still putting each other in specific boxes? Are we, you know, have we not really broken out of the old way of doing things? And this is a challenge and something that does make me think, although I very much try and focus on building other platforms other than sales on Amazon. But it's something to think about for your own attitude and also how you're doing business. So for example, I'm really thrilled by the number of people who are now buying ebooks directly from my website at thecreativepen.com. And if you buy ebooks from me, you'll get the EPUB, the Mobi and the PDF. And I'm also selling audiobook MP3s of the Successful Author Mindset and planning to do more audio. And of course, selling direct from your website is about as independent as you can get, but it involves building up traffic and a tribe over many years, as I've done since December 2008. I've been blogging, podcasting, etc., several times a week for 8 years, basically. So, you know, there is independence there, but it takes a lot of work to get to. And of course, the online bookstores still have most of the traffic. So, yeah, I just thought that was a good blog post to look at, especially as we are all going through difficult times in our various countries at the moment. So yeah, interesting to consider what we're dependent on. I mean, we've got the situation in the UK right now with the you know, the pound dropping, the whole Brexit thing going on. And in fact, I've been really thinking about change a lot because certainly in Britain 2 weeks ago, we didn't think we would be where we are now. We're going to end up with a new prime minister and not somebody who anyone would have thought would have been prime minister a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, what is most certain is change. So I think when we consider what we're doing with our books, we have to look at how we can spread the risk and make sure that whatever happens in the world, short of an apocalypse, and I'll come to the apocalypse in a minute, we are going to do okay and that we've balanced where our income comes from. In other news, Audible launches a podcast subscription service, Channels, for short form news and podcasts for those who don't want an entire book. Obviously, focusing on, you know, it's not for podcasts like this, it's for official ones like New York Times and stuff like that. But it is interesting as it may bring podcasting more into the mainstream. And I think Audible has done a very good job of making audiobooks mainstream. I've been doing a lot of walking and listening to a lot of audiobooks, and it definitely, you know, makes me listen more. You know, I consume a lot of content via audio these days. So that's interesting. Anyway, I thought,
You know, and if you are an Audible subscriber, you get some of that for free, I think, or you can get a short form channel only subscription. So, yeah, I think we will see audio, you know, more and more as the way people consume content. So in my own writing, as I mentioned about the apocalypse, I, for the reasons of doing a long, a long-term pre-order, I set up a pre-order for End of Days when I released Destroyer of Worlds back in May, I think it was March, April, May, I can't remember. Time flies. But basically, I decided the book title would be End of Days because it fits with Destroyer of Worlds, Stone of Fire, Crypt of Bone, etc. It's a nice ring to it. And of course, it's a very evocative phrase. And then I, when I sort of sat down a couple of weeks ago and I was like, okay, so End of Days, what is this going to be about? And then I realized that I don't want to write a sort of cliched End of Days Christian apocalypse type book. That's not what I want to do. So what's so funny is then I was like, oh dear, and now I've got this book title and what am I going to do with it? So but I'm in this for my own writing. I'm in the research stage and the idea stage, and I do love this. I love it a lot. This is my favorite bit, I think. And last night I'm quite enthusiastic because yesterday I was so tired. It's very tiring thinking of all these things, and I was just lying on my bed reading completely random books about stuff, you know, non-fiction books about religion and things, which I do for fun, and found this quote from a obscure Jewish scripture, and it gave me my original spin on End of Days. I'm not going to give anything away, but it also gave me my antagonist. It gave me the mission for the book. It gives me a lot about setting. So anyway, really happy with that. And this happens on every book at some point. I call it synchronicity, the kind of coincidence that happens when you start researching something. Eventually, you find, especially when you do what I do, which is mostly write about real stuff, real places, and then so you can't just make it up. You have to find something that where you go, oh, okay, that really does exist, which is very cool. So anyway, really pleased that that happened. And also when I did a massive walk this week, a 21-mile walk, and on that walk, even though at the time I felt I wasn't thinking about anything, the next morning I got up and kind of plotted very roughly the next six novels and how they will link together, starting basically three different sub-series, so and some new characters and things like that. And this is actually interesting because, and I wanted to mention it, is the reason I'm linking these new series with the old series is because I really struggle to get people to read Risen Gods, which is my only standalone. So there's a little tip for everybody. Standalones are very hard to sell and market profitably because, you know, you've got nowhere for people to go. You know, if you have a trilogy or a series, you can take a hit on the first book in the series, make it perma-free, or, you know, do promotions on that first in series, and people will go through onto the other books, so you can make the money back on the extra books in the series. But with a standalone, it's just super, super hard. So anyway, there we go. Lots there. And talking about walking, I have a big weekend coming up. So next weekend, 16th and 17th of July 2016, I will be walking the Race to the Stones. I will not really be racing very fast, but it is 100 kilometers over 2 days, with a camp at 50k. So you walk 50k, go to sleep, get up very gingerly because everything will hurt, and then walk another 50k. So I'll probably pre-record next week's intro before I do that walk so that you will hear about it the following week. But think of me next weekend. I will be, I think it will be great. And I was feeling a little concerned that I might not make it, but I'm now confident I will make it. So, and training has really helped my fitness and also has helped my crazy mind. I do find that, you know, obviously we all get overwhelmed sometimes, and, you know, very much sometimes it can all just get too much. And I find when I walk that after a while, I don't care about anything. That's exhaustion, I guess. You know, if I'm on about, you know, the fifth hour, I really just don't care. And that's awesome. I think that gives me real perspective. So I really want to carry on walking in the same way I have been doing. And I hope that encourages you. So, you know, if everything does get too much, then just get out and go walk in nature. It helps. Okay, so thanks as ever for your emails and tweets. Reading a few of them. Ashley McKee Leo, who is a new listener, said, listen to your podcast for the first time and I'm hooked. Thanks for all the great info and ideas. Welcome, Ashley. Caro Bagan says, here's a photo of a cemetery in Buenos Aires from one Tapophile to another. Love the podcast and your books. Thank you, Caro. I love getting pictures of cemeteries. That's awesome. Monica Knightley says, wishing that the Creative Pen had written The Successful Author Mindset years ago. Thank you. Monica, and this made me think about this. I couldn't have written that book years ago. And so often we write what we need to learn on the journey and we only write when we get to a certain point. And I feel like The Author Mindset was a book that I couldn't have written before because I had to struggle with those things myself and then share that with you. And which is why the next nonfiction book will be How to Write a Novel, which I'm going to write as I write End of Days. So yesterday I kind of did a bit of both. It was like, okay, I got this idea and the synchronicity happened. Well, how did it happen? What was the process? And then I'm putting that into the nonfiction side. So, and I feel finally ready to write a book on how to write a novel because now I've written like 12 of them and I didn't feel like I could before. Edwin Downwood says, listen to your episode on 3D design and printing during an otherwise mundane commute. Fantastic. AKR Scott, listening between tackling a mountain of laundry and tickling my four-month-old. Nice alternative when I can't be writing. Rebecca J. Clark, listening on the way home from a hike in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. And Sasha Black says, working my way through the entire backlist, notebooks full of lessons. Fantastic. And finally, Lee Anderson says, listening to the podcast from my newly cleared reading writing area under the oak tree in the meadow. And that was a beautiful picture of a summer meadow there. So thanks as ever for your emails and comments and tweets about listening to the show. And I do love getting them. So please keep sending them. I'm at The Creative Pen on Twitter or joanna@thecreativepen.com on by email. And I do love the interaction we have with doing it this way, and I appreciate you guys sharing. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I will share a word from our sponsor in a minute. I also will add that my top income makers at Kobo are my box sets. I have a number of 3-book box sets and also 7-book box set, which is doing well. You don't have to sell many box sets at $15 for an extra good little extra income. And remember that Kobo doesn't have a cap on royalties like Amazon does at $9.99. You can sell at whatever price you want on Kobo and you'll still get the higher royalty rate. And also, I did a blog post this week on how to make box sets and why you should and why box sets benefit customers and authors. So go and check that out. I'll put the link in the show notes if you still doubt the benefits of a digital box set. Right, so this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks especially to new patrons, Simon Goodson, Yesenia Vargas, Olga Kochagina. I'm sorry, Olga, if I've just massacred your name there. Celine Jean-Jean, or Jean-Jean, and Jan Vermeer. And thank you, everybody who supports on Patreon. I really, really appreciate it. Demonstrates that you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And of course, you can support for even just $2 a month, up to as much as you like $10 a month or whatever you fancy supporting with. And you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, here's a word from Kobo and then we'll be into the interview.
Hello, creatives. This is Mark Lefebvre, director of Kobo Writing Life. Digital bundles and box sets continue to be a popular way for authors to offer even more value to their fans. And since Kobo Writing Life doesn't have a cap for the 70% royalty, meaning you can price above $10 US without losing most of your margin, authors are able to benefit from this. They can offer their readers great value and still earn decent money. In the past 6 months alone, we've had many authors earning significant revenue by creating box sets in the mid to high teens and even north of $20. Kobo customers love that, and our merchandisers are able to use them in a lot more promotions. But a quick tip for our merchandising team regarding your digital box set bundles. At Kobo, there's a strong preference for 2D or flat book covers rather than the three-dimensional ones, especially for features where the rectangular standard book cover look fits better in our main page promotions in our email blasts. For more tips like this, check out the Kobo Writing Life blog and podcast at kobowritinglife.com. And now back to our favorite podcast host and yours, Joanna Penn.
And today I'm here with Kate Parham-Kordsmeyer. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, no worries. It's lovely to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Kate is an Atlanta-based freelance food and travel writer and recipe developer for more than 100 publications. She's the author of the cookbook Atlanta Chef's Table, Extraordinary Recipes from the Big Peach, and the founder of Root and Revel, a food and wellness site devoted to natural living. And today we're talking about food writing, which I think everyone will get very excited about. I certainly will.
It's a pretty fun beat.
Oh my goodness, it really is. And this is something we've never covered on the show before. So I'm very excited. So let's, get started just to find out a bit more about you. How did you get into food writing and what's your background?
Yeah, so it's kind of one of those things I sort of fell into. I went to journalism school and always planned on being a writer. And after working very briefly, like a 6 month stint, I think, working at a corporate company for, I was a copywriter. And I hated it. And so I decided to go freelance. Pretty quickly, I figured out that I needed to pick a specialty. I felt like all the experts were saying that if you yourself become an expert in a topic, that you're more likely to get work in that arena and, you know, you become more of an authority on the subject. So I just kind of thought, what do I enjoy doing? What am I passionate about? And It was eating, so I figured, let's try food.
But then take it from there, because I'm sure there's lots of people listening who are like, yeah, I like eating too. But how do you go from like deciding that's the niche you're going to focus on to making a living doing it?
Well, I would say it all starts with pitching and positioning yourself a certain way. And so freelancing is a lot about putting yourself out there, and you're having to send editors story ideas. And so I would just send them food story ideas specifically. So, and trying to establish, you know, maybe other ways I could be considered an expert in food because I'm not a professionally trained chef. So sometimes it was like, well, I have this blog that I develop recipes for, and so you can get a sense of, the way that I cook and the types of things that I cover, or I've been to this place, or, you know, maybe you're Chinese, and so you can write a story about Chinese food because you understand Chinese food, or you're celiac, and you can write a story about gluten-free eating because you have firsthand experience with that. So kind of finding those ways that make you uniquely qualified to write a story.
And so for you, is that Atlanta?
Well, I have not always lived in Atlanta. When I first started writing, I lived in Dallas, Texas, and then I moved to Washington, D.C., and now I live in Atlanta. So the city has changed a lot. So it's more the topic of food that I specialize in and less this specific place.
So you talked there about putting yourself out there and kind of developing a niche that people would recognize you in. So I guess this could come under sort of personal brand. So what are the types of things that you've done to build your personal brand around this space?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is just getting your name out there and writing a ton on the subject, writing for reputable publications. And so when your name starts circulating and, you know, hundreds of or even just dozens of different publications, you start building that brand, you know, building up your social media presence. I would highly recommend any writers have their own website, not necessarily a blog, but just like an online portfolio where you can send people or people can find you if they're Googling certain things. And that definitely helps build your brand. And just a lot of, again, like, there's a lot of outreach that it takes to be successful in this. And so positioning yourself the way you would like to be seen and then pitching editors and potential clients with those ideas and that kind of mentality.
Mm. So how much has writing for free been a part of building that up? For example, Huffington Post is kind of, you know, seen, yeah. You know, well, I think it used to be seen as like a good place to have your writing. And then they kind of just have this blanket, everything has to be free, you know. So how, I mean, so what are the pros and cons of you using writing for free versus making money?
In my professional career, I have never written for free, and I would not encourage people to do that for long, at least. I will say, as a student in journalism school, I did intern for free. So if you didn't have that opportunity, I could see doing a couple stories for free maybe, or for a lower price to build some clips. But I think you have to be really selective in where those places are, because there are certain sites. I mean, the Huffington Post, I think it's BS that they don't pay their writers, and they're one of the, you know, richest companies in the world. So I hate to tell people you could write there, but at least it is kind of a reputable place versus there's some other sites that maybe people haven't heard of, or they're not as large, or, you know, you're not getting as much exposure. And so I think keeping that in mind, you know, is it really going to impress an editor that you've written for some rinky-dink site or somewhere that they know that anybody can write for them? So you're not really proving much. I mean, my mentality is really, if you're going to write for free, I would start your own blog or your own site, and at least then you're building up yourself and not just giving away your work to somebody else for them to profit on it.
Mm. Well, in that case, then, if you didn't start for free, because a lot of people start free and then kind of move up, how do you set, or how did you, when you first started, set your rates? And I guess what gave you the confidence to charge for your writing straight out the gate?
Well, you're providing a service to somebody, and I don't know many, many businesses that would do that for free. So I think that just to demand to be paid a fair wage is pretty standard for any industry. So I think keeping that in mind, and I guess that's where my confidence starts, is just like, well, I'm providing you with something, and so you should pay me for that. And, you know, I have some qualifications. When I started out, I had interned at 4 different magazines, and I had written for free for some of those. So again, it was a little different because I was a student at the time and not already in my professional career. But I would say, I'm losing my train of thought here.
Well, how do people figure out how much they can get paid?
Yeah. So I actually created this calculator in like a spreadsheet that just said, this is how much I want to make for the year, and this is how much, how many hours I want to work a week. And then I kind of figured out, like, working backwards, okay, so that means I need to make X number of dollars an hour to meet that goal. And so then I would charge people accordingly. And as a freelancer, you never really charge people by the hour. It's more of a flat rate fee. But I would say that I would think about things like, okay, if this story is going to take me 5 hours, I'm going to estimate, and let's say you want to make $100 an hour, then I would say, all right, so I'm going to charge $500 for it. And in the beginning, maybe pad that by 10 or 20% just in case it takes longer than you're expecting. But yeah, I think it all starts with figuring out, what do you need to make, or what's your goal, and then charging people that way.
I love that, because the mentality seems to be in the kind of freelance writing space that you have to do whatever you can get, you know, even if like 1 cent per 100 words or something, like people are doing this type of thing, but you're kind of going the other way. So then if you've got this figure in mind, let's say it's a $500 article, do you then go and search for the markets that are paying that rate?
Well, yes and no. I mean, when I first started, I would say that I made a list of, you know, maybe 100 places that I wanted to write for. And then I found out, what do those markets pay? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, if I found out, oh, well, the Huffington Post doesn't pay, or so-and-so only pays 10 cents a word, then maybe I wouldn't even approach those people. But in America, I feel like there's pretty standard rates. You know, national magazines generally pay $2 a word. So that's pretty easy to say, okay, so pretty much any national magazine will be a good place to start. They'll pay me a fair fee. And then figuring, you know, then if you go back to regional or local, and then it gets a little less. But yeah, I guess I would say I didn't really approach people if I already knew that they didn't pay that rate. And there were some people that maybe you didn't know what they paid until you spoke to a person directly. Mm. And so sometimes I said no to something. If I pitched it and they said, yes, we love it, but here's $50 for a 1,000-word feature, then I would say, oh, well, this isn't going to work then. And I would sell it somewhere else.
That's really awesome. I'm glad, you know, it's great to have that confidence. And I know a lot of listeners are like, I don't have that confidence. But clearly, you know, if you start with that end in mind, that's a really good idea. And I was thinking there about the story idea. So you're saying you're pitching a story to this editor. So, you know, and I'm like, okay, so I'm going to make a chicken curry for dinner. That is not a story. So what is a story around food? And what kind of stories do you come up with and pitch?
Yeah. So I think two things. The first is that, like you said, yes, you're always just pitching an idea. You're not writing the piece first and then trying to sell it. A lot of people think it goes that way, and that's not a very profitable way to do this. And especially because every editor is going to want to have their hand in shaping the story and what exactly it looks like. So you're pitching an idea. And then to answer your question about, you know, what are food stories? A lot of what I do is trends and roundups. So let's say, not that you're cooking chicken curry at home, but let's say you go to a restaurant and they're making chicken curry with, I don't know, pineapple. And then you go to another restaurant and they're making chicken curry with papaya. And then you go to another restaurant and you see, oh, and they're making chicken curry with coconut. And so then you say, okay, I think there's this trend happening here of using tropical fruits in curry. And this is a very strange example.
Yeah.
But go with it. So it's picking up on trends and then going back to an editor and saying, I've noticed that a lot of chefs in my city, country, whatever, however you're pitching it, are doing this thing. And I think there's something interesting here. And we should cover it. And maybe there's, why are they doing these tropical fruits? Is it because they're healthier? Is it because they're cheaper? Is it, you know, figuring out kind of the story behind the trend? But roundups like that are a great way to pitch food stories.
Okay, that's really interesting. And have you, I mean, we watch Netflix, so obviously I'm in the UK. We watch Netflix and we watch Chef's Table and The Mind of a Chef. And,
I love Mind of a Chef.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we love all these food porn programs. We watch MasterChef, you know. Has this sort of meant a revival in people's interest? Like, is there just loads of work in food writing because of what's on TV?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's because of what's on TV or if it's all part of people just becoming, people are obsessed with food these days. And I feel like, yeah, there's a ton of work, especially in the freelance space, which was another reason I chose that beat originally, was that There are some specialties that I think are more difficult to find freelance work, like fashion or something where it's more image based. There's not as much freelance. A lot of that stuff is just done in house. And so I had trouble finding that kind of work. And then when I picked food, it was like they were outsourcing almost 100% of their food content. So it was a great, yeah. And you're right. I think people are very into, you know, everybody's a foodie today. So I think people are very interested, plenty of work.
Yeah. And actually, that is interesting, because the other thing that everyone's getting obsessed about is ingredients and getting the best ingredients from the place where they're from, you know. So I think that this will mean more international work as well, right? So, you know, a cheesemaker in down the road here in Somerset could potentially be writing something for an American magazine because of these more international things. So do you do international stuff as well? Or, you know, do you get to go on exciting trips?
Yeah, I get to travel quite a bit. And I've written, most of the international publications I've written for have been in-flight magazines for airlines. But a lot of times it's like, you know, Brussels or is it Brussels Airline? Belgium Air. I'm trying to think. There's a couple international airlines that have called me up and said, we need somebody who knows the DC restaurant scene or who knows the Atlanta restaurant scene. Can you help us with this story? And so that's been a great way to find international work as well.
So they found you just because you're findable on the internet through your website and your SEO, your search engine optimization.
Yeah.
For people they don't know. So what are the things that you put on your personal website that would attract that kind of attention?
Okay, so let's see. I can tell you, look at it here. Like the first thing I say on my website is that I am an Atlanta-based freelance food and travel writer. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of work because people look up Atlanta food writer, Atlanta freelancer, or Atlanta travel writer. So having your city where you're located mentioned several times throughout your site, I think is very important, because that's a great way to find work. Also, I specify that I specialize in food and travel. And so I think if you Google food and travel writers, I'm one of the top 10 results that comes up, which I'm certainly not one of the top 10 food and travel writers, but I think my SEO is working for me.
It's surprising, isn't it? And how, you know, how that happens, but it does when you do the right things with your website.
Right.
You know, and your website looks very good and it's got media on it. It's just about, here's a question around photography, because it seems that, your website has some nice pictures on professional photos, and food writing seems impossible without photography. So do you work with photographers, or do you do a lot of photography yourself, or how does that work?
So the answer is different based on which site you're talking about. For my writer's website, we'll call it, which is just my name, kateparham-kordsmeyer.com. There's not a whole lot of photography on that site. There's a couple photos of me kind of in the field working. But that's more just a place where I have clips and where editors and publicists and those kinds of people could find me. So I don't do much photography for that at all. For the blog that I started last year, Root and Revel, yes, I have, you know, 3 to 5, sometimes more images for every post that I put up. And so it's been a combination of me, you know, fortunately my husband is a hobbyist photographer, but he's got a great camera. And so it's been nice to have that to help. And I've taken some online classes and tried to learn more about photography for that. So, you know, you kind of have to be multi-skilled, I think, to have a blog today. Mm-hmm. But I also work with professional photographers. Actually, the photographer who did the photos for my cookbook lives in Atlanta, and she helps me a lot with the photos on Root and Revel. So that's been really helpful to me, especially in terms of this concept that I think is kind of trendy right now too, called batching, where it's like you do a lot of things, a lot of similar tasks all at once to maximize productivity. So she'll come over and we'll cook two dozen recipes and photograph them all in one day. Mm-hmm. And then I'll have, you know, the next 2 months worth of content, all the photos ready to go.
Ah, that's great. Yeah, that's In Deep Work by Cal Newport. I think that everyone's reading at the moment. He goes into that kind of batching. That's, you know, it's not a new concept, but no, I think you're right. It's how I do these podcast interviews as well now. Like, you know, I've already done a couple of other ones today, but they'll all go out over time. So it just makes it easier, right?
You get in your zone, you can knock things out.
That really works. And then, you know, obviously that photographer is one of your contacts. You said you talked about networking, and I wondered how you manage that, because obviously you now know tons of people at different places, and then editors move. You know, do you use LinkedIn? Do you use a spreadsheet? Do you have an app? You know, how do you manage your contacts?
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of things. I definitely use LinkedIn. LinkedIn can be helpful, especially when you're trying to figure out who the right person to contact at a certain publication is. I mean, Gmail, I keep my contacts just within the email application, very organized. And then I have a zillion spreadsheets for everything. And so I'll make lists of, you know, 50 magazines that I want to write for in 2016. And then I'll have one column with the publication name, one column with the editor's contact, you know, some notes, what I've pitched them, that kind of thing. So it's definitely have to be very organized, I think. And just very proactive. It's a lot of, like I said before, like constant outreach. You're constantly trying to be kept in people's minds and let them know that you're there, that you can help, that you have story ideas, that kind of thing.
It's one of the inevitable things as writers is rejection. So, I mean, So you have your how much does rejection play in the process, and what does no mean for you?
No to me means not right now. And I think it's very important as a freelancer, especially, that you don't take no too personally, because there's so much that they are rejecting that has nothing to do with you. They're not rejecting you most of the time, unless you're just extremely offensive in an email or something. But most of the time they're saying, I can't use this exact idea at this exact moment in time at this exact publication. Mm-hmm. But maybe if you had pitched it 2 months earlier, they might have said, oh, yeah. And they're saying no now because they already have something similar in the works. Or, you know, it's a lot about timing. And so I always, you got to have thick skin, because it can be hard to hear no so many times and not, you know, think, what am I doing? But I just say, keep with it. It's a numbers game. You'll hear no, you know, a lot before you hear yes. But if it's a good idea, eventually you'll hear yes.
Okay, so you've got an idea, the curry thing with fruit. And so you've got your list of editors, and you will pitch that idea to one editor at a time, or you'll just keep pitching that same idea to multiple editors, or will you change up the idea depending on the publication?
Yes, I usually try to pitch only one at a time, because if you pitched even five at a time and two came back and wanted it, you can't really sell it to both. And that looks kind of bad. So it's rare that that would happen, because like I said, it's so specific about right place at the right time. So usually I'll pitch it to one place, and then let's say, okay, so I pitched this curry idea to, you know, Food and Wine magazine, and they say no. So then I take it maybe to Bon Appetit, and maybe they say yes, and then it's done. Or if they say no, then I'll take it somewhere else. And sometimes, you know, editors don't always get back to you right away. So usually if I've pitched it once and I've followed up, within a week or two, and I still haven't heard anything, I'll move on to the next place. And sometimes I'll even say in the email to follow up to them, I haven't heard back from you, so I assume that you're not interested, and I'll market this elsewhere. So at least you're just giving them a heads up. And sometimes they'll come back and say, wait, sorry, I didn't get to it, but we want this. And then sometimes you still don't hear back and you just move on.
And do you do all your pitching by phone or by email, or is there phone? What happens with Twitter? You know, does this thing, does it happen online more these days?
I still do, I would say, 99% of pitching by email. I don't think I would want to pitch in a public forum like Twitter or Facebook, because then other people would see your idea. So I feel like I would keep it more private. And yeah, I think mostly editors don't want to be called unless you already have a relationship with them where you can call and then say, hey, can we run through, you know, 5 or 6 ideas really quick? But emails seems to be the way to go.
And just back on that idea, the ideas thing, do you literally do that? Just sit down and go, right, I'm just going to write down 10 ideas and then see if I can flesh them out a bit, or do you wait for the muse?
It depends. Like, if I just went on a trip, for example, then I might come back and say, okay, here's 10 story ideas I got from this trip. And then I'll sit down at one time and do it like that. If I'm not traveling that much and I'm just kind of, you know, then sometimes it is like until inspiration strikes. But honestly, inspiration is always striking. I feel like if you're out and about, and if you're writing about food and you're eating out a lot, or you're cooking a lot, and you're reading things that other people are doing, you can't help, at least my brain can't help, but I'm always thinking like, how could this be a story? So sometimes I say like, I'll just wait until the inspiration strikes, but that's daily. So I'm always coming up with new ideas.
Yeah, I think that too. And, you know, it's funny. I think they say the ideas are nothing. The execution is everything. So even if you have a great idea, you know, you still have to write that story if someone buys it. The work is ahead of you. But yeah, you know that you've got the right niche if you never run out of ideas.
Yes.
You know, and if it's the wrong niche, you will be wondering why you don't have any ideas.
Yes, that's a great point to make. I think, if I had picked, you know, fashion or I don't know, or something outdoorsy stuff or something, you know, camping, I feel like I would be like, what do you eat on a camping trip? That's my idea for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it was funny. We were watching YouTube because I said to my husband, I've had the same makeup thing for 10 years. And I was like, let's just have a look on YouTube. And then I fell into the hell of makeup tutorials on YouTube.
There's
and
it so was, many.
I know. And I was just like, this is amazing. And then I realized that this is another niche, you know, that I'm just not in. And some people love eyeshadow. And I think that's what's so cool about the internet, right, is you know, you can do that in your niche. So, you know, what you're doing, what I'm doing, this works. But I also want to ask about timing, because you mentioned there it might be the wrong time. What is the lead time involved in these magazines? So are you, like, we're recording end of June, are you already thinking of things to do for the fall or the autumn?
I'm already thinking about holidays, because national magazines work 6 to 12 months in advance.
Wow.
So if you're trying to pitch, I mean, there's some evergreen content that can run at any time, but if you're trying to pitch, you know, a holiday story, you need to be pitching that in the summer, or maybe even the spring, to national publications. But smaller publications, I'd say generally speaking, aside from national, most places work 1 to 3 months in advance. So you always have to be thinking a little bit ahead, except now with online. And sometimes it's like, just think a day ahead, and if you can get it done that quickly. But for print, yes, I would say, you know, 2 to 9 months is kind of the lead time.
Yeah. And if people, let's talk about your book, because I was going to say, if people want book coverage in these types of magazines, it's the same, right? It's a really long lead time, which is kind of crazy. So you've got this cookbook, The Atlanta Chef's Table. So what were some of the specific challenges around writing a cookbook versus freelance writing?
So my cookbook is kind of different, because it's not my recipes, it's recipes from the chefs in Atlanta. So for this book specifically, the challenge was working with over 75 different chefs. It was a lot of wrangling of people, of hounding people, please get me this, I need this, or we have to schedule the photo shoot, or please answer this question. And chefs, you know, are notorious for not really following strict recipes and certainly not making them for the home cook. You know, they would send me a recipe that the yield is serves 200, and it's like, okay, got to scale that back. And or assuming knowledge that, you know, when you're writing a cookbook, you have to assume that the reader has basically never cooked anything before. Mm. And so you can't, yeah, I had a chef give me a recipe once where it's step one, make a meringue, step two, and then he moved on and it was like, okay, no, we have to explain what's a meringue, how do you make it, you know? Mm. And so that was the biggest challenge for that book.
Right. So you were wrangling and kind of being an editor in that situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's really interesting. And how was it working with traditional publishing, which is, you know, generally quite slow, as opposed to kind of doing your own thing as a freelancer?
There were pros and cons for sure. You know, it was a small budget project. And so as it was my first book, I felt like it was kind of an experiment for me to see, is this worth it? You know, what does my hourly rate end up being on this project and that kind of thing? So I would say, you know, this is so specific to my situation though. I don't know that it's true of all traditional publishers, but, I didn't feel like they really provided a ton of support in terms of financially paying me, in terms of helping me promote the book and that kind of thing. I probably would have preferred to go self-published next time, or with a much larger publisher who has a bigger budget and more dedicated staff to help with that kind of thing.
So, and are you looking at doing indie stuff? My audience is generally indie, or at least indie minded.
Yeah. Well, you know, I started Root and Revel last year, and I know it's not a book, but yet. So yeah, I'm definitely starting to do more things where I'm sort of, I would say, investing in myself and trying to start my own businesses instead of always giving my stuff away to other people. Mm. And there's, like I said, pros and cons to each. And sometimes the pro is like, well, you made money right now. And, yes, you know, there's less investment and kind of time waiting while you build something up. So right for you. But yeah, I would love to do more indie stuff.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, I've had other freelance writers on, and it's basically freelance writing is like day job money. You get paid for the hours you work. Mm-hmm. But if you create assets in terms of books, for example, that you own, they will earn you money for the rest of your life and 70 years after you die.
Yes, that would be great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is cool.
Yeah, because people always say, I mean, and it's true, being a freelancer, you have so much flexibility and freedom. And, you know, my schedule is mine, and, you know, hence why I'm in workout clothes at 1:45 in the afternoon. And I love that. But if I take a vacation, I'm not paid. If I take, you know, if you have a kid and you take maternity leave, that's all unpaid. And so there's some downsides to it as well. And I think you're right, coming up with those passive income streams that can be earning money even when you're not working is something I'm trying to do more of.
Yeah. And it's balance. It's just balancing the time you spend on short term money versus the long term money. And it is hard, but I think, you know, everything you're doing, your own site and everything, as well as the freelancing, is building that up. So that's cool. I did want to ask you about TV, because I see you've done a few TV things. And of course, many authors want, you know, or may end up having to do TV and media. So do you have any tips for, you know, appearing on TV or anything around sort of how to be with media?
Yeah, it was a steep learning curve for sure. I feel like I am not a naturally like bubbly, smiley, you know, person. I mean, not to say that I'm boring, but I feel like on camera, it's kind of like, you know, you hear people say, like you need to wear more makeup when you're going to be on camera because it doesn't show up as well. And I feel like that's true of energy also. Like I that when I, the first few videos I did, I kept being told like, you need to smile more. You need to, you know, bring your energy levels up. And it felt so unnatural to me. But when I watched it back, I realized that it didn't look like I was being as cheesy as I felt like I was being.
Yeah. It's like, it's a performance, right? You actually have to, like professional speaking, you have to kind of bring that extra, especially as an, would you consider yourself an introvert?
I feel like I teeter on the edge, but the fact that I've been working from home alone for 7 years now and I don't really miss anybody, I feel like I must be a little bit of an introvert.
Yeah, you're one of us.
Yeah.
I think I don't know how true extroverts manage to do stuff alone for so long. I think they probably have to work in a coffee shop all the time or something. Yeah. You know,
well,
what I mean?
Yeah, people always say that to me. Oh, do you work in a coffee shop every day? And I'm like, I've never worked in a coffee shop. I would much prefer to be at home alone. So
that's cool. Yeah. I did want to ask you just briefly just about the writing itself, and whether, because a lot of my listeners are fiction authors as well as non-fiction authors. So do you find that in the articles you write now, you're actually having to use a lot of fiction techniques, as in you're building up a character? Might be the chef or something like that, and does have to be a story, even if it's true as such. So do you feel like you're bringing in these different writing talents or skills that perhaps, you know, 20 years ago people didn't have to do in nonfiction writing?
Yeah, sometimes. I think it depends on the story and the outlet. Like I said, a lot of my stuff can just be roundups where you're just saying like, five places to eat octopus, you know, and so that's, no, in those kinds of stories, I would say there's not a lot of literary prose happening. But when you're doing more first person stuff or reviews and critiques and that kind of thing, I do feel like you're having to set the scene a bit more. You're having to really transport people and make them feel like they're there with you when you're describing a meal or a trip or a place or something like that. And yeah, certainly there's profiles where you're having to build up a character. But I still think overall I feel very, nonfiction, objective, journalism rather than, I could never imagine writing a novel or anything like that. I feel like those are very different skills than what I have, for food writing.
No, fair enough. It's just watching like Chef's Table, for example. Mm-hmm. It really is a more Chef's Table, you know, where they spend a whole hour like with a certain chef in their country, and it's like about their childhood and all their influences, and it's almost like a fable almost about some of these more famous chefs. So I wonder whether, you know, maybe when you get off the five ways to do octopus and you get to, you know, do these. Well, interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great question. And it's something that frustrates me sometimes, and why I started Root and Revel. And I'm also starting a food and culture podcast myself and some things like that because of that very reason, because I got sick of kind of just writing only these like quick little blurbs that I didn't feel like we're really telling an important story. And with print, that's particularly hard because you have space limitations. And so, yeah, I really enjoy exploring these other formats like audio and video, where you have a little bit more time and you can set up this more of a story and get a more in-depth look at something.
Fantastic. Well, tell us a bit more about Root and Revel. What happens on that side?
Yeah. So the short version is that I went through a slew of health issues a couple years ago, or it's been ongoing for a while. And I had been to a bunch of different doctors and nothing was working. And mostly it was digestion and hormonal imbalances. But they just kept throwing prescription medications at me, and that was it. And so I got really frustrated, and I decided to go cold turkey on all medications and see what was really happening with my body. And I found an amazing holistic doctor who, she is an MD, but she practices more integrative and functional medicine. And she basically like reversed. I have PCOS and hypothyroidism and leaky gut. And I, all through changes to my diet and some natural supplements and just like simple lifestyle changes, I've reversed all of those issues. And so I was just like so blown away by the power of food. And it's, you know, it's still related to food, obviously, but it's kind of telling it from a different side of the story. And so I decided to start a website where I could kind of share what I've learned with other people and hopefully help others who are going through similar health issues find healing.
Which is just fantastic. And I know a lot of people who've had various illnesses who've used food and more natural ways. And I think there's much more of a resurgence in that interest, even alongside traditional medicine, you know, to use food as medicine as well. So that's really cool. Now, I'm very healthy, and a lot of people listening are healthy, but what we are is generally sedentary writers who spend a lot of time. And one thing I do do is hunch a lot. Yeah, even though I'm this is a standing desk, right? But I'm still hunched, you know, because this is, you just end up that way after years of writing.
Constantly.
Yeah, exactly like that. And also, it's the, for me, it's like the 3:30, 4 p.m. munchy sugar need. So as someone who's really into food, what do writers need to do at the 3:30, 4 p.m. munchies or whenever it is, or to help us, you know, keep the mind and body healthy?
Yeah. Well, I can't say that I'm always great at this, but I do try to take like a 30-minute walk every day. So that's one thing I do. And then, you know, getting up every hour and or sometimes even just, you know, stretch at your desk and move around. I think just getting up and moving a little bit is good. And I try to not keep food in the house that I shouldn't eat. So
that is a good rule.
Yes. So, I mean, this is where I think like my background as a food writer comes into play with Root and Revel, because I'm never just going to be somebody that's capable of like eating just like plain steamed broccoli and being like, oh, but it's so healthy. I'm like, no, it still needs to taste delicious. So I've just found, you know, the healthy snacks that work for me, and, you know, try to keep, even though I like having a flexible schedule, I still kind of try to keep kind of traditional work hours. And so, you know, have breakfast in the morning. I'll take a true lunch break where I get up and away from my desk. Sometimes it's just to go sit on the couch and watch TV, but it still feels better than just working at your desk. But I think the moving thing is important, because, yeah, it's so easy to, you know, 6 hours later, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm still sitting here and I haven't eaten. I haven't moved. I got to do something with myself.
I never have a problem with not having eaten. I'm like, oh, those people who are like, oh, I'm so stressed, I forgot to eat. And I'm like, really?
Yeah. I don't forget to eat. Breakfast is the hardest for me though, because sometimes I'm not hungry right when I wake up, and then I'll start working and then I'm like, oh, it's noon and I haven't eaten yet. I'm ravenous. So
yeah, well, that's super. So people can, tell us, where can people find your site and you online?
Okay. So my writer's website is just my name, kateparmcordsmeyer.com. On social media, I'm at KP Cords, which is just KPKORDS. And then Root and Revel is rootandrevel.com.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Kate. That was brilliant.
Yay, good. I'm excited. It was really fun.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.